some of the sounds of the disastrous bushfires that took place over the end of 2019 and the start of 2020. Now, the result of those fires was a devastating loss of lives, houses, land, livelihoods. It was also reported at that time that an estimated 1 billion animals were killed or displaced by the bushfires. Since then, a World Wildlife Fund report, this was in August last year, that revealed that the number is almost three times higher than first thought. Now think about that. 143 million mammals, 2.64 billion reptiles, 180 million birds, and 51 million frogs. 3 billion animals. Extraordinary. Now, thousands of pictures of the Australian bushfires were beamed around the world during that time. But there was a particular image that struck a chord globally. That was the image of a koala clinging to its rescuer, its face and body singed, and its home burnt to the ground. Now, that image must have been particularly soul-destroying to my guest today. Deborah Tabat has devoted decades to the survival of the Australian koala. She's chair of the Australian Koala Foundation and author of a new book called The Koala Manifesto. Deborah, thank you for joining me on Between the Lines.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, title of your book, you've joined the other historic rebels who wrote about their radical ideas on how to change the world, Karl Marx, Che Guevara. What's behind the Koala Manifesto?
Well, if you look closely, Tom, at the image on the front page of the koala, on the cover of the manifesto, we did actually superimpose a koala on a branch over the top of Che Guevara and his gun. Sorry. Because, look, after 33 years, I'm so sick of it. And so people were encouraging me not to use that word, but I do think that the Ten Commandments, for want of a better word, in the book are the manifesto for the survival of the koala, but more so for the forests of Australia and also the river systems of Australia. So, yeah, I'm happy to wear that. And I do want to be that radical in a way, because I think it would be doing a disservice to the young conservationists if you don't show them what they're up against.
Well, you've led the foundation, the Australia Koala Foundation, for more than three decades. I think it's 33 years.
Yes.
What was life like for koalas when you started back then compared with now?
Well, I honestly, you know, when I got the job, I was just told to raise $5 million so that we could fund research at universities. And raising money for koalas is pretty simple. I went to Westpac and Qantas and Ken Doan, and they all were very generous. And at that time, everyone thought that it was chlamydia. But it came, and chlamydia now, of course, is shockingly high levels, because you get sick when you don't have trees or food. So it's logical. But chlamydia has been with them for millennia. It became obvious to me that it was all about habitat. And then it was really obvious to me that it was about who owned those habitats and whether they were prepared to protect them. And by and large, they're not.
Now, you say in the book, Deborah, that you believe wholeheartedly that the koala is probably the only animal that can inspire not just local but global change. They're your words. Why?
Yes, they are. They are. Well, I dream of a Koala Protection Act, because I think all laws in Australia are completely inadequate to protect the environment, and I know that to be true. I also believe that international laws that are supposed to protect the environment and animals are also inadequate. And I dream of legislation called Crimes Against Creatures Great and Small in The Hague that will bring everyone to account for every species. And the only species that I think can pull that off is the koala, because it doesn't hurt anyone, doesn't eat you, doesn't trample your crops, just sits there looking fabulous and brings billions of dollars of tourism.
But Deborah, have we missed an opportunity here? If you go back to the end of 2019, early 2020, the eyes of the world were on Australia, our bushfires, then the pandemic hit. It was hardly avoidable, but did we miss an opportunity on the global stage to make real changes for wildlife everywhere?
I absolutely believe we lost the opportunity. And Minister Susan Ley, the Environment Minister, and she's the 14th Environment Minister that I've had to deal with over my tenure, had pretty much everyone that was necessary in a room at a round table in February just prior to COVID. Now, she could have had a blueprint for recovery of this species and the protection of forests, But all she's done is just continually put Band-Aid on things, because no one really wants to deal with, will we protect landscapes that are privately owned? And I think the politics in New South Wales of recent times are all about, can I knock down koala habitats that are on my private land? And that's why I'm dedicated to new laws. We as a nation are going to have to protect all biodiversity of our country if we are to long-term survive both climate change, pandemics, and keep our water systems healthy and clean, not to mention the koalas and those tragic figures that you said at the beginning.
My guest is Deborah Tabat. She's chair of the Australian Koala Foundation, and we're talking about her new book, The Koala Manifesto. Deborah, in your book you say, I want to paint a picture for you of what koala habitats might look like if we as a global community decide that we want the koala to be safe forever. Question here is, what's that picture?
Oh, well, that picture is some of the forests that I've been in, you know, in my career. And so when I first started going with the scientists into the bush, I remember being in the Pilliga Scrub, which is west of Coonabarabran, and you want to sing Waltzing Matilda. I mean, it's just magic. And imagine what our country looked like at White Settlement. If you look at the pre-clearing maps, which we have on our website, our country was just unbelievably majestic, as was America. And in America, I think there's only 5% of the redwoods left. And in our country, there's only 20% of the koala forest left. So look at the damage we've done. We cannot cut down one more tree. We have to find other ways of being.
One of the intriguing things I found about your book, Deborah, is you mentioned that in 1929, President Herbert Hoover, who presided over the Great Depression, or at least the collapse of Wall Street, he stopped the importation of koalas and wombat skins after taking the view that both species were at risk.
Yes, look, he was a godsend. And when I give my talks in America, they say, well, it was the only thing he did, you know, because they think he was a bit of a dill.
He was a one-term president, but go on, yeah.
Yeah. Look, between 1890 and 1927, we have the manifests of 8 million skins that went to New York and London alone. I truly believe that at least twice that was shot, maybe even more, which would suggest that koalas were in absolute abundance during that time. And so imagine what our forests would look like if those were there. And sometimes when I go into some of the Victorian forests, I actually think that's what it was like. If you look at Mae Gibbs's paintings, for instance, you can often see, you know, she's got two little koalas huddled together. I've only ever seen that once in my whole career, and that was in a Victorian forest. I just think if you look at the historical paintings, especially Mae Gibbs, she was painting the bush as it was. I think that we as Australians have forgotten some of that majesty. I want the people who read my book and Australians to really think, can we return this landscape to what it was? And I truly believe you can.
Now, we're talking about Herbert Hoover, President of the United States from 29 to 33. He had been, little known fact, a mining engineer in Western Australia in the mid to late 1890s. So he may have fallen under the spell of the koalas like everyone else, Deborah.
Well, he did. I mean, that's the thing. Isn't it interesting? He did. And this is the power of them, Tom. And that's why I'm convinced. You know, there are people who are championing concepts of ecocide, which is the equivalent of genocide. But those laws are not getting up because industry has so much heat against it. But who could ever object to a law that says creatures great and small? Otherwise, you can have a dictator that comes into Africa and say, right, I'm going to go and blow away all the cheetahs or the elephants. We have to have international laws. And I'm convinced that I will be taken seriously over time to start championing those thoughts.
Okay, now the year 2000 was another significant year for the American protection of the koala. You spent time in Washington around this time. Tell us what happened.
Well, in 1998, the Koala Habitat Atlas, our signature project for mapping habitats, received a Computer World Smithsonian Award. And so I was in Washington because I was asked to be a judge for those awards for the next two. And so while I was there, I got to sort of go to Capitol Hill and see the lobbyists. And another group had actually nominated the koala for listing under the Endangered Species Act of the United States because they believed that they had a universal role or global role in protecting species. And so that did actually happen. And I did spend a lot of time at the United States US Fish and Wildlife Service lobbying and providing information from our maps, which actually got it up. Now, at the time, that was Clinton and Gore, and they were trying to convince the Australian government that we had to meet Kyoto protocols. We were chastised. You are clearing second only to the Amazon. We have to stop cutting our trees down. And so I could waffle on forever about this, but I know that the koala has global implications, and it is certainly my intention before President Biden and Envoy Kerry goes to the climate talks in Glasgow that I will be sending our maps of the Koala Habitat Atlas, which we have spent 23 years and about $20 million creating, saying, if you protect these forests, you will reduce our emissions, you will be able to protect the koala and millions and billions of other species that are in 20% of our continent. And I'm hoping that will annoy our governments very much.
Before we let you go, Deborah, what did you include in your Koala Protection Act?
Well, the Koala Protection Act is terribly simple, and I modelled it on the Bald Eagle Act. The Bald Eagle Act initially was just one piece of paper which said you cannot touch its trees and you cannot touch its habitat. And so our document is a little stronger than that, but it basically says if a koala tree is on any given landscape, the application is automatically no unless you, the proponent, can prove that your activity is benign. Because the current laws basically say, yep, no worries, mate, you can do whatever you like, and you, the community, have to fight to the death to prove that we're being destructive. And so this would change the onus of proof to the proponent, not to the community. And as I write in the manifesto, I am so tired of seeing weary and exhausted communities having to fight for their landscapes, either for food production or the protection of their waterways or the protection of species like the koalas. And let me tell you, I have had the most amazing life over 33 years going to some of those communities because they always say, you know, let's save the koala because of its iconic power. And I have seen so much of Australia and I've seen so much of it destroyed.
Well, good on you, Deborah. Thanks so much for joining me on Between the Lines.
Thanks for having me.
Deborah Tabbatt is chair of the Australian Koala Foundation and author of a new book called The Koala Manifesto. And we'll put a link to the book on our website.
This is Between the Lines.